Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Today we begin a collaboration with the Marine Biological Laboratory as we bring the Falmouth Forum Speaker Series to the airwaves. The first Thursday of the month for 8 months will highlight speakers who share their expertise in history, music, literature, and of course science. Today our guest is Nipam Patel, director of the Marine Biological Laboratory. Now the Falmouth Forum has been bringing some really interesting topics and guests to audiences for more than 30 years, all put together by the Friends of the MBL, but because of the pandemic this year, it cannot be held in person, so why not bring these conversations to the radio?
Yeah, no, it's a great opportunity, and, you know, during the pandemic, we've learned a lot of, you know, really good lessons about being able to use other ways to reach the community, and, you know, we figured we've done a lot of Zoom things, and people are probably getting a little zoomed out, and it's a great opportunity to do this on the radio.
Yeah. So for those who may not be familiar with the Marine Biological Laboratory, tell us a little bit about the work and the mission.
Yeah, sure. So we were, you know, established in 1888, so we've been here a long time. And it started off as sort of a field station, and it slowly grew into an amazing institution that's devoted to both research and education. And even though our name is the Marine Biological Laboratory, and of course we have a lot to do with marine biology, it's not all we do. So we actually have research in all sorts of areas of biology. So we have a resident research staff of about 22 faculty and a couple other junior faculty and some other positions. So we have about, you know, 250 people here full time. But the other thing we're well known for is our education mission. So we have the best known is the about 24 advanced training courses that are mostly for graduate students and postdocs that we run in the summertime. And so we touch on all sorts of areas of biology.
And now, how has the pandemic impacted research and philanthropy at MBL?
Yeah, so like everywhere, you know, it's had a big impact on us. So when the state shut down, we, of course, shut down pretty smoothly and quickly. And thanks to our dedicated staff, though, we kept, you know, all of the functions we needed to keep our animals and things like that going just fine. And then starting June 12th, we've been able to, you know, slowly reopen our research activities, and that's been going very smoothly. But it did also mean that, you know, people are still working remotely, especially administrative staff and everything. But we are, the big impact it had on us that was really noticeable is in the summertime, because, of course, there was no way for us to run all our in-person advanced training courses, which are known for being very hands-on lab work. So we had to sort of pivot, and we've done a lot of online things for those courses, which has actually gone very well. We've reached over about 7,000 people during that period that we were running some of our courses online.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I think, you know, everybody kind of went, oh gosh, what is this going to mean when we have to shut everything down? And we've all become Zoom experts, which I think probably many of us had no idea what Zoom even was before this. But that ability to be able to be online and do things virtually in some ways has really been a great opportunity, hasn't it? Because it's opened up a whole new world of folks who, you know, couldn't be here in person.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we estimate that about a third of the people that join in for, like, for example, our course presentations were people that we have no record of having an association previously with the MBL. So there are people who've heard about it, joined in. Hopefully, there'll be people who maintain a connection, and if they're young students, they may now be excited to apply for advanced training courses or be here as a faculty member eventually.
Yeah. All right, so your interest in science began at a young age. You were 8 when you started collecting butterflies. I guess not so unusual for an 8-year-old, but what prompted your interest at the age of 8 of collecting butterflies?
Yeah, actually, so I grew up in West Texas in a town called El Paso, and I was a pretty nerdy kid and was always really interested in science and math and everything. And at the age of 8, I found a dead butterfly in my yard, and it was a huge swallowtail butterfly, really beautiful. And I was very excited, and, you know, I read a book on how to mount it, and then the next thing you know, I convinced my mom to sew me nets, and I was sawing off the end of my dad's golf clubs to make nets, and they encouraged me a lot. And so, but it wasn't just the collecting of the butterflies. I became really fascinated by their biology and started raising them. And it ended up being a lifetime hobby. I mean, I think like a lot of little kids, there were many things I collected, But this was the one thing that stayed throughout my, you know, entire life.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about that, the support your parents had, but also you had educators that supported you through this. And I think it sort of speaks to, you know, that importance of sparking that interest in young people. I mean, it seems most kids do have that innate interest in science and nature, but obviously they don't all grow up to have careers in science. But your story sort of remind me, I have a 5-year-old grandson who is really interested in science, and he just kind of, he makes me laugh. He wants to wear his white button-down shirts every day because he thinks it makes him look like a scientist. So we bought him a little lab coat, and I have to laugh. He walks around the house going, aha, my hypothesis is correct.
Yeah, that's great to hear. Yeah, I mean, I think I was incredibly fortunate. So in addition to my, you know, my parents who really encouraged me, I also had some amazing teachers. I think the biggest impact was really when I was in high school, and I went to a fairly large public school there in the town I grew up in. And when I was there, it just had an amazing set of teachers who, you know, and I still can recall their names and their faces, who were my teachers in biology, chemistry, physics, math, and actually even also in history and in English, who really inspired me, and especially on the science side. You know, I was really lucky as a high school student. I was taught papers out of Scientific American articles. We actually had amazing labs that we could do. So I, like, took a class in embryology as a high school student, and we worked on chicken embryos because we could get chicken eggs from the farm and use them in our studies. And then I was really lucky. Back then, NSF funded a lot of programs for high school students to go to universities and work in labs. And so I worked at the UT Austin in the 2 summers when I was in high school, and my first author published paper came from work I did as a high school student. So that really, you know, got me, you know, at a whole new level of being really excited by science.
And your area of expertise is embryology.
Yeah, it's funny. It's something that, you know, I got excited about when I was really young, and it's always stuck with me as the thing I really was fascinated by and wanted to keep studying.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about butterflies. You are an expert in how things develop from eggs to adults, and your lab studies the development of the wings of blue morpho butterflies, for one thing. And these are sort of interesting butterflies in a sense. Talk about the color. I mean, that's the interesting aspect of this. We call them blue morpho, but they sort of have what sometimes this iridescent look to them.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, like we've mentioned, I've, you know, been interested in sort of all aspects of butterfly biology, but when it came to doing research on butterflies, the thing that really piqued my interest was how they generate color on their wings. So there's a lot of really fantastic work on how they generate the pattern, but I became interested in how they generate particular colors, especially green and blue. So it turns out in nature, you know, normally when you think of coloration in an animal or anything like that, you think of pigments. So these would be molecules that absorb a particular color of light, and then what's left is reflected, and that gives you the color that you see. But it turns out that nature rarely comes up with pigments that are good at being blue or green. And instead, there's a really interesting different way to create that color. It's called structural coloration. And it works by actually manipulating light in a completely different way. So it's the way that a soap bubble has color. So the soap itself doesn't have color, but the way that the light interacts with the soap, the film of soap when it's very thin, can create color. And it turns out butterflies do that. So almost all times when you see blue or green in a butterfly, it's rarely made by a pigment. And that's actually true in most animals as well. And instead, it's made by nanostructures, so very, very intricate, you know, highly patterned, very tiny structures. So by definition, those things that are creating this have to be smaller than a half wavelength of light, and they create these colors. And physicists have studied this for a long time, and they understand the physics of it extremely well. What we don't know is how organisms actually make these kinds of structures. We know exactly what they look like. But it's fascinating to think of how a single cell can create something like this. And so that's one of the big things that we're studying in butterflies.
Yeah. So what are their wings made of? They're kind of covered by little scales. We wouldn't
right.
think of that as looking at them.
Exactly. So, you know, probably we're all told not to touch the wings of butterflies. And, you know, if you do, you see what looks like dust, colored dust on your fingers, right? And those are the scales. And so Lepidoptera, the scientific name for butterflies and moths, literally means scaled wings. And so they're covered in these very fine scales. And the scales are, you know, extremely small. So their width is a little less than a human hair, and they're maybe about three times longer or something like that. And so we think of them as being very small, but they're actually part of really what's a very giant cell. And that cell, those cells are there in the wing of the butterfly when it's in the chrysalis. And they grow out and they make that scale. And then during development, those scales then either become full of pigment that gives pigment colors, or they have these nanostructures on them which create these structural colors. So it's those scales on the wing of the butterfly that create the colors that we see.
Yeah, it's really fascinating, too, when you think about, I think this is sort of a magic that you have, you know, people who might bring in the little monarch caterpillars and, you know, put them in their butterfly houses. And, you know, you feed them the milkweed, and then they go up and they make their little chrysalis. And voila, all of a sudden, this little caterpillar turns into this amazing, beautiful butterfly. And that transformation is just magical.
It absolutely is. I mean, metamorphosis is really an amazing thing. And one of the things we've been able to do in the lab is develop really robust techniques for being able to look inside and watch the wing develop during the entire period. So we can make a window in the pupae, in the chrysalis, and actually watch all stages of wing development. So we have some really nice movies of that and a couple species of butterflies. And that's one of the techniques that we're using to try to understand how the scales make these structures.
Yeah. Now, we talked about, you know, you're studying the wing development of the blue morpho, and you're trying to understand the color. Are there other things in particular to the blue morpho that you're trying to answer questions about?
Well, we're trying to understand in general how scales get made. You know, they're fascinating structures, being such a big cell with such a good, you know, very regular organization. And so that we can do in any butterfly. And I should mention that, you know, it's not just the blue morphos we study. In fact, the one that we've made a lot of progress on in trying to understand this sort of blue-green color are buckeye butterflies. And many of you may see buckeyes flying around here in the summertime. And they're, you know, a fairly attractive North American butterfly. They're, you know, maybe an inch and a half across. And they have these big eye spots. But they're mostly brown and orange and white. But they have close relatives that live in Central and South America, for example, that have nice iridescent green and blue. And it turns out that sometimes when you collect them in the U.S., a few of them will have a little bit of iridescence to them. And so we collaborated with a butterfly breeder in Florida who actually, she noticed that there was a little bit of blue in some of them, and she decided to breed the bluest ones together. And after about 12 generations, which took about a year, she got them to be really brilliantly blue.
Wow.
So that's one of the butterflies that we study because we want to know, well, what did she do, you know, by selecting for this blue color in every generation? What actually changed to make them incredibly blue? So we published a paper recently showing exactly what happened to the scale to make it blue. It turns out that the bottom of the scale, right, so the scale is made of this material called chitin, and it's a polymer of sugar, but it's what the exoskeleton of all arthropods is made of. And they sculpt it in this very fine way to make the scales. But in these buckeye butterflies, they've changed the thickness of it on the bottom of the scale so it's just right. So it creates this what's called refraction of blue light. And so that's what gives this intense blue color that those butterflies have. And that's a little different than the morphos. But it's something that we can now study, and we can raise these butterflies. And now we've actually embarked on trying to understand the genetics. So what actually changed genetic in the sequences of the butterflies to be able to have this blue color.
Fascinating. You're listening to the first of our Falmouth Forum lecture series in collaboration with the Marine Biological Laboratory and WCAI. On The Point, we're talking with Nipam Patel, director of the Marine Biological Laboratory, and we'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point, first of our Falmouth Forum Lecture Series in collaboration with the Marine Biological Laboratory and CAI on The Point. We're talking with Nipam Patel, Director of the Marine Biological Laboratory, or the MBL. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. There's a really interesting dynamic between the large blue butterflies and ants.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was gonna say they have this interesting relationship that you would never guess.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely fascinating. So it's not the big blue morphos, but the little blue butterflies that you often will see, especially in the springtime around here. And so the scientific name for this group of butterflies are Lycinids, and they have some of those species in that group have amazing relationships with ants. So the females will lay eggs near the ant nest, and the ants will take in the larvae, and they'll actually take care of it. And the larvae secrete various substances that the ants really like. The ants don't absolutely need it, but they just like these secretions of the larvae. So they will take care of the larvae, and in some species, the ants will carry the larvae up into the trees and let the larvae feed and guard it, and then every evening carry it back down into the ant nest. And so in some of these species, the species is completely dependent on the ants for its survival. In other cases, it's evolved to the point where now the larvae of the Lycinids eat the ant larvae instead, so that's not so good for the ants. But so they have this amazing relationship, and yeah, there was I think a lot of people may have seen an article recently about the reintroduction of something called the large blue into England, and that's one of those species that's also very, you know, it's dependent on ants for its survival. And I think it's stories like that that's what really gets me excited about studying butterflies. You know, it's like, some people will ask me what my favorite butterfly is, and occasionally I point to things that are pretty drab looking, and they'll say, well, why is that so interesting? And I said, well, it's its life history. It's the way it lives that's so fascinating. It may not look as beautiful to you, but, you know, the biology is amazing.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting, too. I was watching a little video about, you know, in Britain, how they had pretty much gone extinct and are now back. And I was watching these little carpenter ants basically you know, fighting off any kind of predators to the larva, you know, the little caterpillars of these blue butterflies. And really, so is this all different kinds of ants? It isn't just one species of ants. Is this many different species of ants?
Yeah, it's several different species of ants. So often each butterfly will have its particular species of ant that takes care of it.
Wow. And what have been some of the most interesting discoveries in your research with butterflies?
Well, I think, you know, actually, to be honest, the butterfly research is relatively new. And so it's something that we've only been working on a few years. And so I think the most exciting things we found are these. One is just sort of the technical breakthroughs of being able to watch the wings develop and all of that. And I think that I described the work that we've done, the work primarily of a graduate student, Rachel Thayer, being able to look at these blue buckeye butterflies and understand what's going on with them. And a couple of students now are also working on a fascinating project looking at transparency in butterflies. So a lot of species of butterflies have evolved to be transparent so that you can see through the wings, and that's a camouflage mechanism usually. And one of the things we've discovered is that they have many, many different ways of achieving this transparency because they've evolved it over and over again. And so we're beginning to get some insights molecularly into how they make some of these changes to get the scales out of the way, or to make the scale smaller and things like that. So those are some of the things we've done with butterflies.
So what applications could your research have into areas of technology or even medicine?
Yeah, so people have often, you know, talked about the ways that these nanomaterials that butterflies produce could be used in both, you know, various technologies and in medicine. So one of the things that we look at, for example, is the way that these transparent species, so if you just remove the scales from a wing, the wing will be somewhat transparent, but if sunlight shines on it, it'll glare pretty badly. So it looks like a piece of, you know, regular glass that's out in the sun, and then you can see it, so the camouflage doesn't work very well. So what they've evolved is an anti-glare coating on the surface, right? So as humans, we think we're so smart because we figured out how to do that, like with eyeglasses. But these butterflies, for many millions of years, figured that out, and that's what they use on their wings. And so one of the things is that, you know, there's a lot of applications for that kind of thing, because not only are they anti-glare, they also keep the wing from getting wet, so they repel water. And so there's a lot of excitement about using that kind of technology in things that we want to build as humans. And so if we understand, you know, how biology has solved these problems, we can understand how to use them for our own needs. And that's, I think, one of the take-home lessons from, you know, biology nowadays, is that evolution's really solved all the problems that you're really interested in. You just have to find the organism that solved that problem and figure out, you know, how it solved that problem. You know, another great example is regeneration, which many people hear at the MBL study. So, you know, we're not very good at regenerating. We can do a little bit, but not a lot. But other animals are amazingly good at it, right? So if you think of Hydra or Planaria, a lot of animals like that or other things that can regenerate nervous system quite well. And so one of the goals of the MBL is to really expand the number of organisms we work on to find those organisms that really help us ask fundamental questions in basic biology. But those often have huge impacts on human health.
Yeah. So what about moths? Do you study moths as well as butterflies?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so everyone always wants to know what's the difference between a moth and a butterfly. And, mm-hmm. you know, really what the situation is that butterflies are just a kind of moth. So there are a lot more moths than butterflies. And butterflies evolved within the sort of tree of moths. And they happen to be one day-flying form of a moth. But, in fact, many groups of moths have evolved to fly in the day. And so some of those things that I talked about with structural colors, a lot of day-flying moths have evolved the same sort of structural solutions to have blue and green color on them. In fact, one of the best examples I use of structural color is there's a moth from Madagascar called a sunset moth, and it's pretty much every color of the rainbow, and it does that all with structural color by having light refraction on its scales to create every color of the rainbow.
I think a lot of people think of moths as sort of drab and not very attractive, but I'm thinking of two that came to mind, like the Luna moth. Look at the Luna moth. Mm-hmm. I mean, is there a more beautiful moth?
Yeah, no, they're spectacular, and we're really lucky in this area in North America to have those and the Cecropia moths and a couple of the other really big Saturnid moths, which are we study them too because they have the little tiny transparent windows in them. If you've ever looked at a Luna moth, on the forewing is a little area that's just clear. And so that's one of the examples we study to try to understand how they generate a little clear area in their wing. But they are spectacular, spectacular moths. And they also have, again, really interesting biology. If you look at the Luna moth, they have no mouth parts. They cannot eat as adults. So they store up all their food as larvae, and then they emerge as adults, and they live for, you know, only about a week or so. And the function of the adult is to find a mate, lay eggs for the next generation.
The other interesting moth I think that a lot of people are curious about is the sphinx, that butterfly sphinx moth. You know, it looks like mm-hmm. a little hummingbird.
Yeah, yeah. No, they're again, you know, a beautiful little moth, and the way they fly is spectacular, where they, you know, can maneuver forward and backwards, and they visit flowers all over the place. Yeah, that's another one, actually, again. You know, they have the transparent area in their wings. And those ones are interesting because what happens is the scales fall off of those areas of the wing. The moment they emerge from the cocoon, those scales fall off to give the transparent areas.
Yeah. And that's something I learned recently, that moths are cocoons and butterflies are chrysalis.
Yeah.
Right?
Right, yeah. So the cocoon is the outer part. It weaves, and there's still a case in there that looks just like a butterfly chrysalis as well. And it's just that the butterflies don't spin that elaborate cocoon around them. Butterflies will often spin just like a little saddle that holds the chrysalis onto a branch or something, but nothing more than that, whereas a lot of moths will spin very elaborate, thick cocoons.
Oh. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you have a comment or question for us this morning, 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So how does your work with butterflies inform or complement the other research that's going on at the institution? You kind of touched a little bit on that.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, there's the research at the MBL is very broad. So we have people who do ecosystems research. They study, for example, how nutrients cycle through the marshes and things like that. We have people that study microbiomes in the environment. And we have, you know, a group of scientists that are really interested in regeneration and tissue morphogenesis and development. And so, you know, we're really broad in our thinking, but I think that, you know, we touch on each other's work in really with this fascination with how basic biology works, how organisms work, and use that information to, you know, be able to answer all sorts of questions. And a lot of it, like I said, is really basic work, is that we have really fascinating questions that we want to answer. And so many times, the answers to those questions lead to consequences that we wouldn't have imagined. So I think, you know, we've seen that over and over. I think just most recently, if you really read the history of how CRISPR came around, you know, the genome editing technology, it wasn't because someone thought that they were going to, you know, designing this in order to treat human disease. It was a very basic biology question that was being addressed that led to this incredible breakthrough. And I think that's something that the MBL has always been great at, is to really do that basic research that drives forward all areas of science.
Mm-hmm. And that's another interesting aspect of science, is you answer one question and it usually sparks two or three more, right? So sometimes you get these discoveries.
Absolutely. So one of the things that my lab's worked a long time on, in addition to the, you know, before the butterflies and is continuing, is we work on various aspects of how evolution changes development. And for a lot of that, we work on crustaceans. We work on little amphipod crustaceans. And it's been the last, you know, several years have been great for this work because we've been able to apply, for example, the gene editing technology, CRISPR, to these little animals and been able to do a lot more experiments, really wonderful experiments leading to understanding how the right limb gets put on the right segment. And in fact, even questions like where wings have come from, thinking about crustacean, you know, how they came from a crustacean ancestor. But every time we do an experiment like that, we just get even more questions that we have to answer. And I think that's one of the, you know, the beauties of science. We do get answers, but every answer leads to a whole slew of new questions.
Yeah. So there's so many different species of butterflies and moths, and you've been collecting for a really long time. Is there something that you don't have in your collection that you are still searching for?
I don't think so. I mean, you know, I don't have that. Yeah, it's not like I have everything in the world. I have, you know, samplings of some of the species I'm most interested in. And you know, I was lucky when I was very young. I traveled quite a bit with my family, and so I was able to do a little bit of collecting throughout North America and in parts of Africa and India. Now, actually, when I travel, I just take photos. And so now my fascination is really to get photos of many of the fantastic butterflies that I've seen in collections or in my own collection, is to actually see them in the wild. And so that's one of the things I really, now I'm very excited about, is running around with my digital camera and macro lens getting actual pictures, because I think they look actually more spectacular when they're alive than when they're in a collection.
Yeah. So it's sort of like how birders, right, where they used to collect the feathers and things, and now it's the same kind of thing. We take photos, we check them off our lists. But so when you're looking at different species to study, you know, like we're talking blue morpho is one you study, you're looking for something in particular in a species to study, right? I mean, like,
yeah.
I mean, could it be? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, like with this trying to understand nanostructures, fortunately for us, there are probably like, you know, more than 100 really nice papers written by optical physicists who have taken butterflies from collections, worked out how that particular color works in that species. And so we can look at the literature and we can say, well, this is for this particular question we want to address now, this is the butterfly species we, you know, we need to work with. And so we've been able to do that in quite a number of cases. So like the blue morpho you mentioned, you know, that's a structure that's been studied now for decades. And so that was clearly one that we were, you know, quite interested in. But there are quite a number of others that create colors in very different ways. And they've been described. And some of the ones, you know, we're discovering as we go along using the collection I have. But it makes it possible for us to pick and choose which species we want. The next challenge is it's not easy to get all of these butterflies. And so that's something that, you know, we work on and try to figure out how we can get them, get permits to be able to have them and things like that. So we've been doing all of those kinds of things.
Yeah, and there's been a lot of concern about declining populations of butterflies. I mean, we see that in our own yards. There aren't as many monarchs or question marks or pink ladies and all of these butterflies that we've been seeing in, you know, in big numbers are declining. What are your concerns there?
Yeah, I think the big concern is, you know, habitat loss. So, I mean, for these butterflies to survive, right, they need the proper places to live. And, you know, as humans encroach on more and more land, that's been a big issue. And then there are, you know, some instances clearly where the widespread use of insecticide has really hurt populations of all sorts of insects in general. And I think all of those things are contributing. And it's great to see people get excited about, you know, trying to protect the habitats, trying to raise the butterflies and things like that. The monarch's a great example, but, you know, it's only one of, you know, an incredible number of species that we need to be concerned about. But I think, you know, if people kind of understand, like, locally, if they understand what the right food plants are, but often, you know, the food plants, those are the ones that the larvae actually need, are pretty weedy plants, right? Sometimes people are actually actively destroying them instead. But it's great to see people get more excited about that and try to understand what they need to plant and things like that. So all of that will help.
Yeah. Is there a difference between, let's go for the monarch for a second, because that's what a lot of people will bring indoors, letting a monarch stay out on the milkweed or bringing the monarch indoors and feeding it to milkweed? Is there any difference in, you know, how they would migrate or you know, anything that would impact them once they become butterflies? Is there a pro or con to that, or is it equal?
No, there's actually a big difference. So there's a very nice paper by a colleague of mine at the University of Chicago, Marcus Cronfrost. He published recently that if you raise monarchs in captivities indoors where they're not exposed to the normal environment, particularly not exposed to the normal day-night cycle and sun, when the adults come out, they don't actually know when and where to migrate. So you really, if you're going to raise monarchs, it's a good idea to keep them outside. You can protect them with netting, but you really should raise them outdoors so they know where to go.
Oh, good point. Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. It's our first of our Falmouth Forum lecture series in collaboration with the Marine Biological Laboratory and CAI on The Point. And we'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point, and it is our first in the series of Falmouth Forum lectures in collaboration with the Marine Biological Laboratory and CAI on The Point. This morning, we're talking with Nipam Patel, director of the Marine Biological Laboratory. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Earlier in the hour, we touched upon some of the educational opportunities, and MBL has an advanced research training course. And you describe those students as fearless. So what is the program, and why do you call them fearless?
Yeah, no, it's one of the real jewels of the MBL. So during its long history, it's always, or I think for over 125 years, we've had these advanced training courses in the summer here at the MBL. So right now we offer, there's about two dozen of them, and they're, you know, all of them, most all of them are either 6 to 8 weeks long. And they're mostly graduate students and postdoctoral students, and they come in various topics. So we have several neuroscience courses. We have a course in development embryology. We have a course in physiology and so on. And, you know, it's an amazing environment. The courses are a typical course is about two dozen students taking the class, and then just a huge number of faculty, many of them staying the whole time, others rotating. But what we really do is we teach the students, like you said, to be fearless, you know, to learn quickly, like various techniques, and then they have amazing instruments and equipment that's here at the MBL that they can use. And then we just tell them to just try things, you know, to dream big, to think of questions they could try to address while they're here, and then go for it. And, you know, one of the things, our mantras is if you're not failing, you're not trying hard enough. Because if you're just doing something that's been done a million times and you get it to work, well, it's fine when you're learning the technique the first time. But then you want to, as quickly as possible, say, okay, I've got an exciting idea. I just want to try this. And we try as much as possible to encourage students to do that. And the environment here in the summer is just spectacular with all of these students and all of these visitors here. And we really, I think it's one of the, like I said, one of the things. It's what attracted me to the MBL. So this is, I've been here as director a little less, almost 2 years now. But I've been coming here to help teach in the summer courses for 20 years. And so they are, you know, it's just fantastic. And like I said, we've got the facilities for doing all of this. So one of the things we're trying to do at the MBL is to expand out all that excitement of education outside of the summer. And because we have the building, we have the equipment, so we've been offering a variety of courses. One of the things that we got launched that we were really excited about is classes, very intense lab classes for secondary school students, for high school students. And we're really excited to get that going again. Of course, it took a hiatus during the pandemic as well. But, you know, just as I said in my own background, I was so influenced by those opportunities I had as a high school student. We're really committed to providing those opportunities to high school students now.
Yeah. It's really exciting. And you mentioned that if you aren't failing, you aren't trying. And that there's an important lesson in failing, right? I mean, because we don't succeed, especially when you think about all the research that happens. You know, you're not successful every time. So there's a lot of lessons to be learned in failing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, some of the really interesting insights we've had in the lab come from experiments which technically failed, but the results of the experiment, you know, led to a completely new insight, which ended up being a big research direction of the lab eventually. So I think, you know, that science is full of examples like that.
Yeah. And I think, you know, maybe a lot of people don't understand sometimes how research is funded. And that's a whole, we probably could spend a whole nother show on that. Yeah. But, and a lot of times you do kind of have to play it safe when you're pitching something for some kind of funding for your research. They want to know that it's going to be successful and there's a lot of politics involved. And so tell us a little bit about the funding, how some of this research is funded.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, right, the major funders, you know, federal government, the NSF, NIH, and things like that, you know, that's a lot of the funding here at the MBL, as is most science institutions, come from those sort of sources. And yeah, they have a reputation for wanting to play things pretty safe, you know, that you pretty much have to know that this is the set of experiments you're proposing is really going to work out. And there's a downside to that, because a lot of the most exciting science comes from kind of the blue sky stuff where, you know, you have a really exciting idea, you don't really know that it's going to work, but you really want to try it. And that's one place where philanthropy comes in. You know, it's very important. So is the MBL, you know, has had a lot of history and success with having, you know, people who really get the excitement of science and the excitement of trying something that's really out there to get, you know, to launch these kinds of projects. And so it's been an interesting combination of the two.
Yeah. Molly writes, can your guest elaborate on the milkweed tussock moth? I'm a gardener and recently have been seeing butterfly weed and other plants completely decimated by this caterpillar. I want to save the plants, obviously, but I'm also wondering if these moths are native or otherwise worth supporting more than these flower beds.
You know, I'll go ahead and admit right now that that's not a species I'm familiar with. So, you know, you'll have to turn to something
else.
Okay,
we'll save that for the gardening show. Carl in Acushnet says, a friend in the Orlando area has seen monarch caterpillars early in spring before the ones in Mexico leave their winter roosts. They eat the tropical milkweed, and he has, as fast as he can, he replaces them from a greenhouse he buys them from, and he sees many in his small yard. So do these monarchs travel up the East Coast and then return, or do they stay down south? It seems like the monarchs that come in my yard only lay eggs on the small first-year tropical milkweed that I start from seed each year and devour every leaf, and never lay eggs on the established plants that keep coming up year after year.
Yeah, it's interesting. So the monarchs, right, have ended up spreading across a huge area of the world, in fact, now. So you can find monarch butterflies everywhere because they've moved with, you know, the humans who've moved the various food plants around. And so they do, you know, we always think of monarchs here, and they migrate down to Mexico. But not all monarchs do that. So I, you know, lived for many, many years in California. And in California, they move to the coast, but they don't go down to Mexico. And the same thing in a place like Florida. The monarchs don't need to go to Mexico from Florida because the environment's perfectly hospitable in the wintertime. And, you know, monarchs have ended up in Hawaii, and monarchs in Hawaii certainly don't try to get, you know, back to Mexico. They just stay in Hawaii year-round. So you're going to find that local populations of monarchs will behave in very different ways because they've adapted to where they've ended up.
Hmm. And Patty says, you sort of answered this, but there might be more. Are you anticipating any everyday practical applications emerging as a result of butterfly research?
Yeah. So like I said, you know, our particular research is in these nanostructures, and there's a lot of excitement for, you know, things like I said, the technology to make transparent objects non-reflective, but also some of these things are, these nanostructures are also used as methods to deliver drugs into patients. And one of the downsides right now to the way these nanostructure materials are made is they're often made of compounds, or the processes make them somewhat toxic. But if we can make them in a biological way using living cells or mimicking the way that that's done, we could make them so that they would be much safer. So that's another example of an application that can come from that.
So where do you see the MBL 10 years or even more down the line? You know, what are you envisioning for the future?
Yeah, so I think, you know, it's always been an incredibly strong place scientifically. But I think, you know, as we grow, we'd like to grow our resident scientist program. So we'd like to have an increasing number of resident scientists that run year-round labs here. But I think the other big thing is we want to expand our education program so that it is year-round, so that, you know, we have our advanced training courses in the summer and we're completely full in the summer and we don't have capacity for more than that. But we've got all of this, again, buildings and equipment that we can continue to use for education the other 8 months of the year. And we'd like to see it really be filled. And so we, you know, we're now part of the University of Chicago. We're going to have University of Chicago undergraduate students coming in the non-summer months. I mentioned the secondary school programs, having high school students here taking classes. So we would love to pretty much be full year-round instead of just really, really full in the summer and then, you know, just our relatively small number of resident researchers here the rest of the year. And, you know, the two big initiatives we're working on are advancing imaging. You know, we've always been good at microscopy, so that's something that we really want to see us grow in. And the other one is increasing the number of and the tools that we have in a lot of non-standard research organisms, especially marine ones.
And are you anticipating working with more area high schools?
Yeah, absolutely. So just before the pandemic hit, we were just about to welcome some local high school students from, you know, Falmouth High and from a couple other schools on the Cape. And then that's right when we had to shut down. So we're, you know, excited to get them here. None of us know exactly when we'll be able to do that. But, you know, we've been teaching courses in sort of, again, in microbiome research and in being able to do sort of advanced imaging and embryology and things like that. And we're really excited to get back to it. So I would love to, you know, be able to get a lot of those high school students here. And I'm really looking forward to working with the local community on that.
Yeah. And then just thinking of this sort of a distrust of science, mostly coming from the current administration, which does hamper, I think, you know, what scientists are trying to achieve. What are your thoughts on that? Do you feel like that will turn around, or do you feel like that's a trend that's going to continue?
Well, I hope it, you know, I definitely hope it turns around. I mean, I think people have to understand that, you know, science is something that's always new information is being gained. And so, you know, someone can say, well, yeah, but, you know, a few years ago you said this and now you're saying that. And that's because we are learning more and more all the time. So I think part of the burden is on scientists to, you know, clearly explain to the public what we know and don't know, how certain we are of certain things. And, you know, this is our best estimate of something at the moment that could change as we get more and more information. I think to make the public aware of also how we do science, I think that's why it's another reason it's so important to have younger students really come here and have an experience. Even if in the end they don't want to be scientists, they need to be educated in what science is all about so they can understand what they're reading. They can understand that, yes, you know, this is very serious stuff that scientists do that, you know, makes a difference to everybody.
Now, for our butterfly aficionados, your butterfly collection is now housed at the MBL. Is it ever on display or available for the public to view? I know right now it's probably not a good time, but is there a plan for that?
Yeah, I'd like to do that. So right now it's in the Lilly Building near the Rare Books Collection is where my butterfly collection is. But yeah, I would love to have somewhere where, you know, some of the specimens could be displayed, along with, you know, little explanations of why this is such a fascinating butterfly. Like I said, you know, for me it's not just their beauty, which is very clear, but it's their life histories and the stories they tell us about biology. And so yeah, I would love to be able to set something up like that, maybe in the Lilly Auditorium or one of the other buildings, so when the public is here for events, which we're hoping will, you know, be not too far off in the future, they'll be able to take a look and see, you know, a changing display of some of the butterflies. And we may be able to put out some of the living butterflies as well, some of the cultures, so people can see.
Oh, that would be great. And are we still identifying new species of butterflies and moths, or have we pretty much identified them all?
Oh, we're definitely identifying new species all the time. Even in areas that you think that you would never find a new species, you find them. So there's a great story in the Midwest of the United States. The butterfly here, you see it here too, the black swallowtails. So people realized when they were raising them that the larvae seemed really different. There were two different types of larvae, and then they realized that they were actually two very different species of butterflies. They just as adults, they look almost identical.
Huh.
And so that was a new species that no one had ever realized was a different species. So there's always surprises.
Yeah. Just have a couple minutes left. I just wondered if there's some research that's going on at the MBL now that you're particularly excited about.
Oh, I think, you know, one of the things that as I mentioned, one of our initiatives is to develop a lot of new research organisms for our work. And we're developing that with quite a number of species. But one of the first ones that we put that effort into were cephalopods, were the squid and cuttlefish and octopus. And, you know, one of the breakthroughs that was made here at the MBL, primarily the work of Josh Rosenthal and Karen Crawford, was to be able to do genome engineering now in the local squid. And, you know, so that opens up a whole new set of questions. And we're hoping to expand the repertoire of organisms and tools that we can do that those kinds of experiments in. So that's a great example of, you know, that was something that the MBL really set out as a goal a number of years ago, and it's come to fruition. And so it's, I think, those kinds of big breakthroughs that we're really excited about here at the MBL.
Yeah, very exciting for sure. Nipam Patel is the director of the Marine Biological Laboratory. Thanks so much for joining us this morning in our very first of the Falmouth Forum Lecture Series on collaboration with the Marine Biological Laboratory and CAI. We have seven more. The first Thursday of the month, we air the series. Thanks so much for being our first guest.
No, thank you very much.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.